know, into air. Because, of course, Allah has to have that power for him to make something wajib, and he has to have the power and authority to make something haram. Yes, he does not force us in absolute compulsion to do these things. We do these things out of our own free will, but our own free will is within this framework of the overall power and the commandments and the authority of the Almighty Allah. Again, these are quite profound ideas and concepts that really need to be talked about, you know, more in order to be able to understand. But in the end, we do understand that it is not absolute compulsion, neither it is absolute free will. But as the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and Imam Hadi alayhi as-salam have taught us, it is a matter between the two matters. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi as-salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
On June 18, 1994, when Francisco Oscar Lamolina, the referee of the opening game of the World Cup, blew into the whistle, over 77,000 spectators were shouting in jeers at Pontiac Silverdome Stadium in Detroit. It was the first time that the World Cup was being held in the U.S. For a month, all eyes all over the world were fixated at the event. The shining stars of the world of football, like Romario, Roberto Baggio, Hristo Stoichkov, and Gheorghe Hagi, filled the stadiums to the brim. With every goal, yellow or red cards, the stadiums were in uproar, like the day when Nigeria thrashed Bulgaria with 3 goals and the fans of the team were madly shouting out of joy. People who had traveled thousands of miles from Africa so they could watch the games up close. Those days were good days for the people in Africa, but not for all the residents of the continent. Right at the time when people across the world were glued to their television sets to watch Nigeria's exhilarating display of skills, in a part of Africa, one of the most brutal genocide in the history of mankind was underway. The Tutsi and Hutu tribes in Rwanda were up in arms against each other. In 100 days, 1 million people, nearly 20% of the population of the country, were killed. The Hutus that had control over the government killed so many people from ethnic Tutsis that the tribe lost 75% of its population. The genocide eventually stopped after the UN intervention, but it proved that death in Africa is an ordinary thing that can take place. However, the genocide in Rwanda wasn't the largest massacre Africa was witnessing. In the 60s, amid the French occupation of Algeria, over 1.5 million people died in the country within a span of 2 years only for asking for independence. If you think it was the bloodiest incident in Africa, you'd better go through the history of Belgium, a small country that perks in Western Europe and is shown in a light of democracy and freedom these days. But in the not-too-distant past, it experienced one of the most horrifying governments in history. Leopold II, the former Belgian king, who ruled over the country from 1865 to 1909, occupied the Congo in Africa. During the 44 years of occupation, he slaughtered over 10 million people in the Central African country. Yet, despite the high number of killing, Leopold II is not on top of the list of the biggest murderers in history. As it was announced in the 60s and 70s, the biggest and scariest murderer in Africa, unlike what the majority of the people in the world imagine, was a woman. The number of the people this woman put to death is higher than the number of the people killed by Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, and even Genghis Khan put together. Even higher than the number of the people who were killed during the bombing of Dresden in Germany and the victims of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear bombing. Apparently, Rachel Carson is the biggest murderer in history, and yet nobody was aware for a long time. Everyone admired Carson for being a nice human being and a great author, and also for her role as an environmental activist. She has been praised in numerous books, articles, and reports, but in the end, the mask was removed from her face. They said that the woman who had a charming smile on her face in all of the pictures and the only thing she cared about was nature was behind the death of millions of people in Africa. The deaths happened after she genetically modified mosquitoes. If we take a look at history, we'll find out that Rachel Carson's life in many ways had striking similarity with major criminals throughout history, like Hitler, who used to paint pictures when he was a young man, or Stalin, who was a choir singer. Carson was into art, literature, and poetry. She was born in Pennsylvania and graduated from Johns Hopkins University in 1932. After getting a degree in zoology, she started her career as a journalist. 15 years later, she displayed so much talent and skills in the field of aquatic creatures that she supervised all publications in this field. During those years, she tried books besides working as a journalist. Her books are on environment and the seas, which gained Carson fame. She resigned from all of her posts in 1952, so she could concentrate mainly on writing books. The most important book she wrote in that period was her autobiography. The US media, as well as many chemists and physicians, say the book changed the fate of millions of people in African and many other parts of the world. Carson's name turned into the nightmare of people who were grappling with malaria.
In Africa and Asia, the mosquito is a mass killer. More than 2 million people die every year from malaria, which mosquitoes transmit.
In 1962, Carson's Silent Spring was published. In her book, she has talked about the detrimental health hazards on pesticides on food and agricultural products, and that the widespread use of DDT helps the poisonous substance permeate into plants and remain in their texture for a long time and cause disease. They say the publication of the book and raising such issues banned the use of DDT across the world, including in Africa. But the ban in Africa led to the emergence of an old disease across the continent. Back then, many chemists criticized Carson for her theory and claimed it was basically unfounded.
In Miss Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, are gross distortions of the actual facts, completely unsupported by scientific experimental evidence and general practical experience in the field. A suggestion that pesticides are in fact biocides destroying all life is obviously absurd in the light of the fact that without selective biological activity, these compounds would be completely useless.
Based on figures and documents proposed by Dr. Gordon Edwards, an entomologist at the University of San Jose in California, stated in his paper that the elimination of DDT helped the mosquitoes that transit malaria to reproduce without any barriers. In a few years, the population of the mosquitoes grew so large that millions of Africans fell victim to the disease and lost their lives, according to Edwards in an article titled Bias, Misinformation, Half-Truth, published in 1992 in the Science and Technology magazine. The Silent Spring has been one of the deadliest books in history as it sent millions of people in Africa to their death. Some people put the number of fatalities at about 50 million people, larger than the number of the casualties in the Second World War. DDT was first synthesized in 1874 by Othmar Zeidler, but insecticidal properties were not identified until World War II. But from 1939, it was widely used by soldiers on farms to fight off lice and typhus. Major chemical companies produced millions of tons of DDT every year and earned whopping amounts of profits. So it was only natural that the companies were outraged over the ban imposed on production and sales of DDT. Therefore, when Rachel Carson published her book, they spent about $250,000 to debunk her claims.
Measures which research laboriously has developed.
In the media, they called her a radical, hysterical spinster who only keeps cats and hates genetics. It was at that time when Carson was introduced as the biggest criminal in history who caused the deaths of millions of people. Even today, the claim continues to be circulated by some people. But the reality is, Rachel Carson was never a criminal or murderer. In fact, the ban on consumption of DDT has nothing to do with her. In fact, 5 years before Carson's Silent Spring was published, the United States Environmental Protection Agency reached the conclusion that using DDT has detrimental effects on humans' health.
A government-backed scientific panel today reported that pesticides may indeed represent a grave threat to mankind.
The average American already has more DDT in his body than is permitted in the meat and fish that we eat. It does not go away, it accumulates, and it passes to babies through their mother's milk.
So the consumption of chemical substance sharply declined from 1957 to 1967, and in 1979, it was completely banned. At that time, it was revealed that DDT is not effective in killing malaria because they quickly adapt themselves to the insecticides. In fact, now everyone knows that Carson and malaria are irrelevant. But powerful businesses and political lobbies in the 60s and 70s grilled the scientists for her studies, and many people detested her. It has happened many times through history. Rachel Carson is only one example of politicizing science.
We have heard a great deal about their safety, but very little about the hazards, very little about the failures, the inefficiencies. And yet the public was being asked to accept these chemicals, was being asked to acquiesce in their use, and did not have the whole picture. So I set about to remedy the balance there.
In 1898, German medical student Hermann Rottmann announced that tobacco causes infection and tumor in the lungs. Laborers at tobacco fields were exposed to the highest risk. He continued to hold to the wrong belief until 1912, when some doctors tied lung diseases to smoking cigarettes. In the 1920s, when lung cancer was being identified, it was attributed to various agents like asphalt and the effects of poisonous gases in World War I. Smoking cigarettes did not have an outstanding place on the list. But in 1939, Hermann Müller in the Cologne University in Germany studied 86 patients with lung cancer and publicly announced the relationship between smoking and the disease. The idea was soon approved by the scientists in the US and Britain, as well as the American Cancer Society. The news was a massive shock to the tobacco industry all over the world, and their shares at the stock markets plunged. Six major cigarette-producing companies decided to find a way out of the crisis. On December 14, 1953, the directors of the companies gathered in the Hotel Plaza in Manhattan and told the reporters that the alleged link between smoking and lung cancer needs further scientific research. They announced that the claim that cigarette is a carcinogen is unfounded, and there are no scientific proof to back the claim. Those who stood up against tobacco companies would face harsh reactions from the companies and the scientists affiliated with the companies.
Four packs of cigarettes a day. I am 55. Yeah! Wait a second. Tell me if I don't look 20 years younger than this.
These people were on many radio and television shows. Their message to the audience was, "We're not sure if smoking cigarettes can cause cancer." In fact, the doubt ruled the minds of the people. This is known as the trade of doubt.
This is America today. The pace fast, the competition great. We live with more tension, more emotion, more concern about our health, more everything than ever before.
In 1979, a promotional video footage named "Smoking and Health, The Need to Know" was made and broadcast by tobacco companies. The video was played for hundreds of thousands of Americans. During the screening time and after that, the audience was posed with some questions. They were asked, "Is it likely that the concerns raised over smoking and the health hazards are wrong?" A year after the survey, they achieved unbelievable results. There was a 17% decline in the number of those who already believed that smoking can cause cancer. It nosedived to 59% from 76%. The survey was conducted in other countries like Britain and the Netherlands. In the 1980s, Philip Morris spent millions of dollars to persuade the people in the UK that they should not worry about secondhand smoking. Meanwhile, a study conducted in the Netherlands in 2011 showed that 61% of the people in the country believe that smoking poses no threats to non-smokers, while throughout these years, many doctors and scientists have tried to prove to the people that smoking, cigarettes, and nicotine can be very hazardous and can lead to many diseases like lung cancer. They published different kinds of figures to push back those who capitalize on doubt. But those who were on the other side of the story, namely tobacco factories and their affiliated scientists, wielded huge power. Now it has come to light that the scientists knew for decades that cigarettes and its compounds are very hazardous for human body. The documents leaked in the 1980s and 1990s by some tobacco company staff revealed that the owners of the companies had known as an established fact from the 1950s that smoking can cause cancer. In one of these documents dated 1953, Claude Thigaud, one of the scientific advisors of Camel Tobacco Company, wrote to his director that the tobacco in cigarettes is one of the main factors behind lung cancer, and added that there is a direct correlation between smoking and lung cancer. A decade before that, Emma Harris Palmer, the head of the research center of Lord Yard, acknowledged that there is ample evidence to prove the link between smoking and lung cancer.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. This is Muhammad Jawad, the host of the program Islamic Laws, with our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid, as always. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. My pleasure.
We are going to talk about, some of the jurisprudential laws which are related to this great month, the month of God, Ramadan, and Ramadan Mubarak to everyone, wherever you are, if you experience it this day or the other, or you have started your Ramadan previously, it doesn't matter. Just try to remember us and keep us in your du'as in this blessed month. Let me start off this episode actually with this question. Why Muslims in general, and why do Muslims in general and Shia Muslims in particular have a problem or even the difference of opinion when it comes to establishing the beginning of a lunar month? And normally it dawns on everyone, if they are not, in light, when it comes to Ramadan, it becomes so abundantly clear to everyone that there is this difference of opinion, right?
You're right. Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, the difference which occurs in regards to the beginning of a lunar month is something natural, mm-hmm. and there's nothing you can do about it, because different scholars have their own instruments of driving Islamic laws and their own principles based on which they deduct and infer legal rulings from the religious sources. So they have different understanding. And of course, this should not be a cause of concern.
Mm.
Everybody should act according to the verdicts and fatwa of his own mujtahid,
mm-hmm.
Who's supposedly the most qualified mujtahid.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter whether you are, for example, following mm-hmm. Grand Ayatollah Khamenei or maybe Grand Ayatollah Sistani. As long as you're acting according to the fatwa of your marja,
mm-hmm.
I think there'll be no problem.
Right.
You have to stick to the mu'minin, the believers, should stick to the fatwa of their believers, of their mujtahid, and inshallah, there will be no problem. Of course, if there is any problem with regards to the beginning or the end of the lunar month, so again, the problem can be solved, and it's not a big deal as long as you understand
mm-hmm.
that every scholar, every mujtahid has his own opinion and his principles based on which he infer the legal rulings.
Could any technology be into consideration when it comes to sighting of the moon, or, for example, for the end of the previous month and the beginning of the new month?
Well, that's where the shoe pinches,
uh-huh.
in fact, because some scholars are of the view that in the early period of Islam, okay, there was no such device, no mm-hmm. technology, no telescope or something to be used to ascertain
right.
the beginning of every month. So that's why they still hold that there should no such instrument must be involved, and that every individual must establish the beginning of the month through their own naked eyes.
Right.
On the contrary, some other scholars, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, is of the view that if you use any device such as a telescope, mm-hmm. binoculars,
yes.
or anything like that, which could ascertain the beginning of a lunar month, there is no problem. Even if you fly, using a helicopter and go over the clouds to find the moon or to establish the moon, and then come back and make an announcement declaring the beginning or the end of the month, there is no problem. As we can see in Iran, for example, a lot of people are commissioned to go out and they take their instruments with them, and they use even helicopters to go up and see the moon without any cloud preventing visibility.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Just stay with us.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. مرحب مرحب يا رمضان أحيي قلوبنا بالقرآن حل ليالينا بالقيام أهلا أهلا بالصيام.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javed, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the great month of God, the month of Ramadan, with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, when it is not clear, or when we are not sure whether this is the last day of Sha'ban, which is the preceding month, to the next month, the month of Ramadan, or if it is the first day of Ramadan, what should we do? Can we fast that day, that Yom HaShag, basically?
That's a pretty good question. Since we do understand that that a lot of people who do not have access to their mustahid or to the offices of their mustahid, since they are living in other countries
exactly.
or maybe even in a far flung area, having no connection, no telephone number or nothing, so they doubt whether it is the end of the Shaban or the beginning of the month of Ramadan. In such cases, of course, it is necessary to, in fact, one cannot observe fast with the intention of observing the fast of Ramadan, because as long as you are not sure that the month of Ramadan has started, you cannot make niyyah of fasting or observing the fast of Ramadan. You can fast, but it could be the fast, a qada fast, or it could be a kind of fast on behalf of someone else. Maybe you can make niyyah of fasting on behalf of someone else. So fasting is basically permissible, but not with the intention of observing the fast of Ramadan, because you're not sure that the month of Ramadan has set in. Okay. Now, if later on you come to know that it was actually the first of Ramadan, then it will count as the first day of Ramadan, and there's no objection.
So should we leave the niyyah, the intention, open to God to be read? Like, if it is the last day of Shaban, then it would be considered as a kind of recommended
fast,
right?
Yes.
If it is the first day of Ramadan, then it would be considered as a compulsory, actually, fasting, right?
Yeah, you cannot be, decisively or make a niyyah that it is the first of Ramadan. Probably there is a chance of that day being the first of Ramadan, but you cannot. And the thing is that everything has to do with your niyyah, with the back of your mind,
right,
what you are actually intending when you are fasting. So if you intend to fast only, it's just a fast, and
yes,
not the fast of the month of the first day of Ramadan, then that's okay.
Just a bit. You mentioned here in your answer that, you know, Muslims live everywhere.
Yeah.
Different corners of the world, right?
Yes.
So if they don't have access to the local religious scholars, can they base their horizon, wherever they are, on the horizon of the Muslim nations, like, for example, in the Middle East, and listen to the their religious authority or marja regarding, for example, whether it is the first day of Ramadan or the last day of Shaban?
Again, it's a very difficult question, very challenging, because they may not have the same horizon, okay? And someone who lives in, for example, in Australia, may not have the same, he may not have the same horizon as we do here in the Middle East, or those people living in America or in the United States.
Exactly.
Europe
is very close to the
Middle
East.
Yeah, Europe is very close.
But Australia and America, Latin America, they are far away.
So that's why we see that the scholars differ in their opinion.
Exactly.
When it comes to the beginning of the month. Even some religious scholars, for example, a few years ago, let's say, one of the religious scholars who's very well known across the Middle East said that, okay, for example, today is the first day of Ramadan for the people in the Middle East, but it's not the first day of the Ramadan for the people in, let's say, South Africa or
yes,
maybe North America. So because they think that maybe they have their own instruments through which actually they establish the beginning of the month of Ramadan, and we do not have anything to say with regards to the instruments or maybe the principle, the procedures they follow to ascertain the beginning.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/Ian. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program. Anshar Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan. Sheikh Javid, we all know that niyyah or intention is, if not the most important, but at least we could say that it is one of the most important elements of every act, especially when it comes to worshiping God, right? Not only in prayer, but also in fasting or in some other religious rituals and acts. So if a person is undecided, not sure whether they should fast or not, what should they do? If they fast, would their fast be valid?
Just as there is a hadith which clearly denotes that innamal a'malu binniyat, so every act of worship depends squarely on the niyat that you have. Okay, if you do are undecided, it means you have no niyat. You are doing an act, or you are not doing an act. So you are undecided. So you have no intention. So if somebody is undecided in his niyyah whether to break a fast or not to fast, or fast actually,
yes,
like the fast of Ramadan, or maybe he decides to do so, immediately, maybe after he remains undecided, his fast becomes invalid. Because when you begin to hesitate or decide not to fast, and then again you change your mind to fast, that means your fast has become void and you can never remain undecided. That's why it's very much important that you, as a believer, a practicing person, yes, must begin and form your niyat before the dawn, before actually the Fajr time.
Yes.
And that's the beginning of the time when you are supposed to form your intention.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Javad. We bid you farewell and keep us in your duas. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahruddin was.
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan.
Mawlavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Quran.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly lives of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries, personalities, ulama and scholars during the history of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two Islamic scholars from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Shaykh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
All right, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the Fuqaha of the 13th century Hijra. He is among the students of Shariful Ulama Mazandarani and Sahib Jawahir. He is mainly known as Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani. His original name was Mullah Muhammad Sayyid Barfurush Mazandarani. So many outstanding details are about his life, his marja'iyya, his struggles against Babiyat and Baha'iyat in Mazandaran province in northern Iran. But before that, Shaykh Rouhani, give us some details about the early life and early education, is better to say, of Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Mullah Muhammad Sa'id Barfurushi Mazandarani was born in 1187 of Hijri Qamari. He was among the great jurists and scholars in the 13th century. And of course, he was among the students of Shariful Ulama Mazandarani, was known as Sa'idul Ulama al-Mazandarani. So in about his, let's say, scholarly life and characters, we can mention this point that Sheikh Al-Ansari, radwanullah ta'ala alayh, knew him as more scholarly figures compared to him. That's why he was known as Sa'idul Ulama.
Yes.
And of course, he was once suggested to take the position of marja'iyya and za'ama of the Shayyu. But of course, he rejected that and directed the people towards the Shaykh Al-Ansari, radwanullahi ta'ala alayh.
Yes.
And of course, he was born in a village called Divkala. Of course, it is part of, it's a village in a province called Babil nowadays,
yes,
which was known as Barfurush in the past.
Yes.
In that time, and of course, he was he died in 1270 in this village and that he was, yes, born, and he was buried in Masjid Jami of that, let's say, city. And of course, about his scholarly life, we can mention this point that after his education or being educated,
yes,
he came back to his village and of course,
yes,
lived there. This is one of the very important, let's say, characteristics of this great scholar, that he turned back to his, let's say, original kind of city that he was born there, to serve the people. And of course, he missed also the chance of becoming marja because of this,
yes,
coming back to this his village.
Yes.
But serving the people, serving the followers of Ahlul,
yes,
Bayt was more important for him as taking any kind of position.
Yes.
That's why this, the known or the title Sa'idul Ulama is the title that he deserves, that he was really Sa'id, means,
yes,
prosperous and, let's say, happy,
yes,
person. Yes.
That's right. And the position of marja'iyya, or it's better to say religious authority on that time, was so much important. As you said, Shaykh Al-Ansari, after the demise of Sahib Jawahir, was chosen by most of the people. But Shaykh believed that maybe Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani is more a'lam or is more knowledgeable than him in affairs. So he sent him the letters to Iran. And then Sayyidul Ulama says that, I've been for some years away from teachings and the fatwas. So for you, Shaykh Al-Ansari, it's better to accept it. Shaykh Fadai, so much respect based on knowledge was among these scholars and ulama at that time. This is really an interesting point, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, سيد العلماء مازندراني chose not to be a marja. Mm-hmm. And we can say that this was a custom among our scholars. Usually they escaped from these positions. Vice versa nowadays, we can see that people try and struggle in order to get social and political position. They claim that we want to help people, we want to serve people, but usually the ones who struggle in order to get the position, they want to help themselves more than the others. Yes, maybe they help other people, but they are focused on themselves and their future. But yes. Among our scholars, this was a custom not to accept this position, not because they didn't feel responsibility. No. If they felt that they were not someone, there is not someone better than themselves, mm-hmm. they would accept it.
Yes.
Because of that responsibility.
Yes.
But if they felt that there is someone, even one person better than me, that he can bear this burden,
yes.
Usually they never accept it. For
yes.
example, at that time, he believed that Sheikh Al-Ansari is better than him.
Himself.
And he didn't accept that. Maybe we say so, it is something usual and ordinary because the other one was better. We say that because we are not at that position.
Uh-huh. That's right.
Imagine that someone invites us in order to be in some, I don't know, institute, in some organ,
yes.
organization. And then, after a while, they want to promote us. Do we accept someone else to be promoted instead of us? I don't think so.
Yes.
We say, this is my right.
Yes.
I tried a lot. And
yes.
now the promotion is my right. I have to be promoted.
Okay.
You know, accepting the position of Amarjaya was a great promotion
yes.
for a scholar.
Mm-hmm.
But why they didn't accept that? Because, you know, they know the real religion.
Mm-hmm.
Religion is a knowledge you get from God, and then you have to teach it to other people.
Yes.
Not to gather something for yourself
yes.
by this religion. You know, religion shouldn't be a tool in order to improve your life.
Yes.
For example, Amir al-Mu'mineen, we heard a lot that he has a very poor kind of life.
Yes.
But usually our youth don't know that Amir al-Mu'mineen has a very great income.
Yes.
It was not like Amir al-Mu'mineen didn't have money.
Yes.
He had a lot. Like our scholars.
Yes.
You know, some scholars like Ayatollah Barafurushi, I don't know, Sheikh Ansari, they had a very great access to money
yes.
because of that wujuhat.
Yes, yes.
But usually they lived like poor people.
Okay.
So that is the real science and knowledge
yes.
of religion.
That's right. And another interesting point about, especially about the life account of Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani, is moving back to his own homeland in order to guide the people religiously, answer their religious questions over there. The sense of commitment that they had to their homeland and the people of the homeland is really fascinating. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Sheikh Rouhani, one of the outstanding points about the life of Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani was his struggles against Babism or Babiyat on that time. What was it exactly and who were the Babists?
Yes, of course, this part of his life is really significant because Babism or Babiya is a kind of deviation or alteration that is made in the Shia, unfortunately.
Yes.
And of course, it is a deviated kind of sect that was born in the history of the Shia by the help of colonizers. It was a project that was based on colonialism.
What is it exactly? I mean, what do Babis believe in?
You know, Babism is a kind of belief that there are some people who claim that we are the gate through which you can enter the hidden kind of sphere of life of the Ahlul Bayt, particularly Imam al-Asr. So at the beginning, they were claiming that we are like gate. Bab means gate, door.
Yes, yes. Okay.
By which you can get access to Imam al-Asr. But later, they changed completely this idea. Uh-huh. They claimed that we are the gate by which you can directly access to God.
Uh-huh.
And we are like superior than even the prophets.
Maybe they even claim that we are
prophethood.
Imam
yeah, too, yeah, of that? Course. Okay. Okay. More than Imam, they claim uh-huh. prophethood finally that was totally a kind of mm-hmm. deviated, let's say, sect. So that's why many of these scholars raised against them and actually resisted against them, tried to criticize them. Among them is this Sayyidul Ulama, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Alayhi,
yes.
who actually fought against them, who actually criticized them, challenged them. So his efforts made against this Babism was really significant in the history of the Shia. Actually, he protected the people
mm-hmm.
against the attacks made on the people by these Babists or the followers of this deviated sect in the history of the Shia. That is why it shows that how much important is that when your people, when your nation, mm-hmm. when your society is attacked by the false ideas, false ideologies, or false kind of sectarianisms,
yes.
You have this responsibility as the scholar to get back to your own homeland and
yes.
protect your people against these false kind of ideologies.
Yes.
That's why, of course, as you rightly mentioned, it is really a significant part of the scholarly life of this great scholar.
And Sheikh Fadai, the commitment that such ulama had on that time regarding such movements, fake movements inside the religion of Islam, especially the Shiite Islam, is really outstanding. We know that on that time, there was no social network or media working on that time, but such people were really brilliant enough in order to get notice of the false deviations inside Shia Isnashari Islam and then stopping them and completely removing them from the scene of the society, isn't it?
Yes, you know, this kind of action among our ulamas shows us that the theory of secularism mm-hmm. is wrong. You know, for example, Babiya, first of all, they claim that this is a kind of religious societies.
Yes.
We are, as my brother mentioned, the gate for Imam Zaman. But after a while, they tried to get the power, having the influence on the society. They want to be in the center of power. And so at that time, our scholars felt the responsibility not just to stop this deviation in our religious knowledge, but to stop this social deviation, political deviation, in order to distort the guidance of religion in our society. As you see nowadays, I just want to mention one of the aspects of Babiya.
Yes.
You can see that their two important cities are Akka and Haifa
uh-huh.
in Israel.
In Israel, that's
and
right.
they have a very good relationship with them.
Yes.
Why is it like that?
Uh-huh.
Do we think about that? If Israel is the enemy for Iranian people
yes.
and for Shia.
Yes.
And Babis, they claim that we are the real Shia.
Mm-hmm.
If they are Shia, what don't they have any problem with Israel and Zionism? And why doesn't Zionism have any problem with them?
Yes.
Why are they focused in those cities? If you just search internet
yes.
for Babi and Baha'i and see their castles,
uh-huh.
you cannot say building.
Okay.
They have some castles
yes.
in Haifa and Akka.
Yes.
So you know, by this relationship, they showed their reality, their hidden reality. And that's why some scholars like Muhammad Said Barfurushi, they try to stop them. They know this future.
That's right.
That they want to destroy the religion, to have just a deviated sect.
Yes, that's right. Such a broad outlook that such a scholars like Sayyidul Ulama Barfurush Mazandarani had. Thank you very much, Shaykh Fadai and Shaykh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Sayyid Barfurush Mazandarani, mainly known as Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani. He passed away in his hometown and village, Divkala, in today's Babol in northern Iran. It was the year 1217. His body was taken into Masjid Jame, or the main masjid or mosque of the city, and he was buried over there. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, and may Allah protect the ulama who are after guiding their people, especially religiously speaking, in different cities all across the world of Islam. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman.
In the limelight. Palestinians abducted by Israeli regime forces since the start of the war are returning to Gaza with harrowing accounts of mock executions, constant beatings, and humiliating mistreatment. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, Palestinian men kidnapped by Israeli regime forces since the start of the war in Gaza have told Middle East Eye how they were physically tortured with dogs and electricity, subjected to mock executions, and held in humiliating and degrading conditions. In testimonies to MEE, one man who was taken by Israeli regime forces from a school in Gaza, where he had sought refuge with his family, described how he had been handcuffed, blindfolded, and detained in a metal cage for 42 days. During interrogations, he said he had been given electric shocks as well as scratched and bitten by army dogs. Other men also described being electrocuted, attacked by dogs, doused with cold water, denied food and water, deprived of sleep, and subjected to constant loud music. One of the men, Muaz Mohammad Khamis Mehrdad, who was taken prisoner in Gaza City in December and held for more than 30 days, said, "They did not spare anyone. There were 40-year-old boys and 80-year-old men." As well as three men taken prisoner in Gaza, M.E. spoke to a man abducted in a raid in the West Bank city of Qalqilia, who said he had been blindfolded, stripped naked, and hung by his arms during interrogations in which he was repeatedly beaten and burnt with cigarettes. He also described being held for days in freezing conditions in which he was not allowed to sleep, and of a troop urinating in a bottle and handing it to him after he had requested water. All four men describe being forced to strip naked and being constantly beaten and abused by Israeli regime troops during their weeks-long detentions. MEE has also spoken to a number of other former detainees who also describe similar experiences to those of the men in this story. Their accounts of torture and abuse follow similar allegations made by human rights monitors. The Zionist regime's conduct of its war against the resistance group Hamas in Gaza is already the subject of an International Court of Justice case in which it stands accused of genocide and ongoing war crimes investigation by the